is a short story, but it may take a while. It was one of those days that maybe you should and maybe you shouldn't. And we thought maybe we should, and it turned out we probably shouldn't. But anyway, it rather comical at times. But it was so terribly typical, I just had to relate it to you. It starts out in the morning at 6 o'clock. Mr. Crane, you got a crank time at 7:15. Got to take the colonel out to Snuffy.
Right.
They wake you up almost a full hour before you need to be at your aircraft. This allows you enough time to lay there and think, aha, I've got a little extra time, I can catch an extra 40 winks and fall back to sleep. Wake up 10 minutes after your crank time and be late. Well, they very carefully plan this so that you'll think you've got more time than you do. It takes me all of maybe 10 minutes to get up, get dressed, put my chicken plate on, grab my 16, grab my helmet, and get out to the bird and be ready to go. But, no, they wake you up an additional 45 minutes earlier. They insist on thinking that somebody actually eats breakfast around here. Not even the people in the mess hall eat breakfast. And if they don't eat eat breakfast, you know nobody else is. Well, anyway. So, this was a very lucky occasion. I very carefully clocked my 40 minutes to be exactly 45, and got up, got dressed, put on my chicken plate, threw my M16 over my rifle, over my shoulder, and marched smartly out to my aircraft. After giving it a thorough pre-flight, which took all of 5 minutes, strapped myself in, turned it on, and hovered over to the VIP pad. There I wait for the illustrious ACIC / airfield commander / Captain America / I've been flying for 5 years, goddammit, I know what I'm talking about, / the kid. Well, he has been flying for 5 years, but I never would have guessed it until he told me. But when he told me, then I believed it. Yep, he has been flying for 5 years, because he flies exactly like somebody who's been flying for 5 years would fly like. Well, okay, so it's one of those days. You look one way and there's clouds there, and you look another way and there's clouds there. You look another way and there's clouds there, and you look straight up above and you see a sucker hole saying, come on, it's VFR on top. Sure enough, it was VFR on top of the world at about 20,000 feet. It was VFR. Well, we crank up anyway. Well, maybe it's just a little scud around Song Bay. Sure it is, Captain Nelson. We'll just stay low level here at 40 feet above the ground until we break out. Okay, or break up. So we do. We take off in a mad dash. We get on GCA. GCA can't find us because we're too low. Well, forget GCA. We'll just follow the road out. Okay, this is really a good idea. Captain Nelson has been flying for 5 years, and he has been flying helicopters for 5 years, and he knows the safest way in which to fly in a helicopter. He's been doing that for 4 years. That was the 4 years prior to this, contrary to popular belief. Well, anyway, so we diddy-bopping down the road, 100 knots, and 40 feet off the ground, and lo and behold, what should we see coming over at the horizon at least 140 knots right straight at us? You guessed it, a Chinook. Now, when a Chinook low levels, it's kind of like a cyclone low leveling. Behind the Chinook is a tremendous cloud of dust, which is just exactly like the IFR conditions 40 feet above us we're trying to avoid. Well, we missed the Chinook, fortunately. maybe it's not so fortunate. We went IFR and dust at 40 feet with trees all around and who knows what else. So Captain Nelson pulled it up into the clouds where we would at least be sure we wouldn't run into a tree. Most embarrassing to run into trees. Again called GCA and said, "Where am I?" GCA says, "Unable to locate due to low altitude." Well, by this time we assume that the Chinook's dust has settled and begin to start down, hoping to break out before we crash into the ground. Well, fortunately, at 50 feet we broke out. This is 50 feet above the ground. And we maintained our 50-foot altitude with VFR, and this is what you call VFR below. So we maintain our VFR below. And the colonel comes up somewhat disturbed. The colonel is a very elderly, gentlemanly type man of at least 50, I'm sure, 35 of which was spent in the Army. And he has no less than 6 radios on a console back behind us, with 2 of them completely secure that he can transmit top secret coded messages to any B-52 within 500-mile radius of where his location is. It's a real work of art. The only problem is, due to Army maintenance and Song Bay conditions, nothing ever seems to work. Well, anyway, the colonel comes up, says, "Tom, how fast are we going?" Tom is Captain Nelson, the aircraft commander slash airfield commander slash Captain America slash he's been flying for 5 years, goddammit, he knows what he's doing. Answers back very authoritatively, 85 to 90 knots, sir, that's 103 to 118 miles an hour. Okay. Wow, I guess that told him, didn't it? If he didn't like his airspeed in knots, he could have it in miles per hour. I've often wondered what a GTO would do down a Vietnamese road 40 feet off the ground. Well, anyway, a few moments later, the colonel comes back on the intercom and says, "Tom, you will be careful, won't you?" Now, this is the most unusual thing for a colonel to say to the aircraft commander. I mean, this really is the first, a first in Vietnam for me. "You will be careful, won't you?" Like his mother would say, just departing out for school when he was in the first grade on the first day. "You will be careful, won't you?" Now, what is Tom going to answer? "No, I'm not going to be careful. I'm going to be a raving idiot. Only idiots would fly in weather like this." "Yes, sir, I'll be careful. Everything's okay." Now, the colonel really has no reason whatsoever to ask this. After all, we're still alive. We've gotten dusted off. We missed a head-on with a Chinook already. So, there's one. We missed crashing into the trees when we went IFR in the Chinook's dust. There's two. And we missed again when we broke back down in, broke out of the IFR conditions rather than into the ground. So there's three. So I figure we're batting 1,000 already. Now the colonel should obviously be able to see by those odds that we can handle anything that should arise, no matter what. And he's back there saying, "You will be careful, won't you, Tom?" And Tom answers, "Yes, sir." The mission is one of the most important missions that I have yet been assigned in Vietnam. They're closing down Snuffy, turning over all of our fire bases to the Arvins, which seems like a good deal. I think the Arvins should have all of Vietnam, to tell you the truth. As a matter of fact, I don't know why we ever took them over in the first place. But anyway, we did. And so now we're giving them back. And the colonel has to go out and see that we give it back to him. And it does, I guess he won't take the Snuffy firebase commander's word for it, that the Arvins have it. But he's got to go out and see for himself that the Arvins have it. So, this is the reason for this most important mission as I said before, it's probably one of the most important missions that I've yet run in Vietnam. So, after Tom, you will be careful. I was really worried now, because that meant the old man in the back was worried. Well, we fly by Betty with a harrowing escape. It seems that Betty has decided to shoot a little artillery. Now, artillery is a very unique thing. It's a tremendous-sized bullet with a big, big charge that goes boom. Now, we shoot it into the jungle to blow up trees and monkeys and lions and tigers and wild boars and deer and anything else we happen to hit. Every now and then we kill a few friendly mountain yards. Every now and then we shoot down our own helicopters who happen to be flying through a GT line. It's a funny thing about these guns. They don't arm until right before the bullet impacts, but anytime a 45-pound projectile that is something in the neighborhood of 3 inches in diameter comes through a helicopter, it seems to do irreparable damage immediately, causing it to fall out of the sky like a rock. Well, anyway, it's the normal procedure that when you're going to shoot artillery, you post it with the air advisory. The air advisory is in Song Bay. Betty is about 30 clicks to the northwest of Song Bay towards the Cambodian border. There's a road that runs all the way from Song Bay to Betty. It's normal procedure that you do not shoot rounds so that they impact on the road. You can shoot over the road. Maybe you could shoot under the road, but you can't shoot to the road. Well, Betty is on a hill that is about the same elevation that we are above the road. It's on a little mole above the road and looks down upon it. Consequently, they very often shoot artillery over the road. Every now and then they get uncoordinated and decide not to post it. It always amazes me that they just out of random decide not to post artillery. They assume that no aircraft would be flying in the vicinity because of the IFR conditions, which is logical thinking. The only problem is we have a very, very important mission, and we have an AC who's been flying for 5 years, and he's also the airfield commander and can give himself a special IFR clearance, and he knows what the hell's happening, goddammit. So, here we go. Well, after the blast, you guessed it, we flew directly under the howitzer that was doing the shooting. The shock wave almost tipped the aircraft over, although the projectile itself, it either went over us or between the rotor blades, between us and the rotor blades, or under us. Whichever is really of no consequence. It did not actually make contact with the aircraft, but the sonic boom following this tremendous projectile of 40 pounds and 3 inches in diameter out of a 155 howitzer is something like you wouldn't believe. While it isn't exactly the magnitude of a Chinook rotor wash, it definitely has the same characteristics, except it doesn't kick up any dust. But it bounced the air around. Now the colonel is really worried, because he just doesn't understand this at all. He thought we were taking fire. So he clutches his M16 while his aides clutch their 45s and look out the window like they really know what's happening. They're just convinced that the gook shot a B-40 at us that missed. I look up on a hill at Snuffy, and the guys with the cannon look down at me and say, "Wow, that was a close one." But the airfield commander, who's also the aircraft commander, who's been flying for 5 years, knows what the hell's happening, and he calls them up and promptly chews them out for not having posted artillery. And they call back down saying they posted their artillery. Well, it seems that we go through an Arvin L&O, and sometimes he's not too reliable, but especially when he's not even awake at 7:30 in the morning. So we continue on with our little journey. The colonel in the back seat is really uneasy now. As a matter of fact, he'd like to stop and take a rest stop, except there's no restrooms along the road, and, well, you just don't sit down in the middle of nowhere just because the colonel is about to come unglued. A Snuffy in sight. Well, we call in Snuffy. Here we come, blazing down the active. Snuffy was upon us before we got our call off, but before we landed, we had clearance to land. Anyway, We shut down. The colonel jumps out. Very much enjoyed to see the ground again. To be standing on the ground at somewhat of a velocity less than 100 knots. And we shut the aircraft down, prop up our feet, pull out our Playboys, begin reading for the afternoon, because we know it's going to be a long time before the colonel works up enough nerve to climb back in the helicopter to fly home. So there we sit. Well, after the first 2 hours, and thoroughly digesting my Playboy from end to end, being completely sore from point to point, from sitting in a helicopter and being dusted off by the aircraft coming in and going out, I decide to take up my trusty M16, walk over to the rifle range, and shoot a few rounds to keep in shape, check my zero, and relieve my anxieties against the higher-ranking world than I. The chaplain, who is a jovial character, fits the perfect description of Friar Tuck in Robin Hood's Merry Bunch, goes with me. It's really an unusual chaplain. He carries his own, believe it or not, Browning high-power automatic, chambering 13 rounds of 9mm Luger ammunition and one extra magazine. To give you an idea about this chaplain, I'll tell you more about the chaplain later. Well, anyway, the chaplain and I walk over to the artillery range, which we see a guy out demonstrating his fantastic ability with the M60 machine gun. The M60 machine gun, by the way, is just about one of the most worthless pieces of junk I ever have seen in my life. All it does is work, and that's about it. You're totally unable to hit anything. Well, after a few brief cans in the air and shooting at M16 magazines down the range and getting my barrel good and hot, burning all the grease and oil off of it, filling my chamber full of soot. The M16 does this. The more you shoot it, the dirtier it gets. It's a finicky rifle that likes to stay clean. So cleaning between each magazine is advisable, although not always you're not always able to do this. Well, anyway, we get into a contest. And we suggest that I can bounce a can farther than you can. This is to the guy with the 60. And he says, you can what? And I'll say, oh, no, you can't. I can bounce a can farther than you can. So we start. And I de-link his belt, which is an endless supply of ammunition, at the 20-round mark, loading myself a 20-round magazine. And I said, I'm ready. He throws his can out about 15 feet in front of us and begins shooting full auto. Da 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 da. I would say maybe out of his 20 rounds, 5 of them actually hit the can and bounced it out 20 yards in each bounce. The can ended up approximately 100 yards away from where we started. I take the same can, throw it out about the same. I take another can, throw it out about the same distance, put my 16 on semi-automatic, and shoot one shot at a time. Pow, 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 pow. And I would guess out of my 20 shots, 17 of them hit the can, each bouncing at a succeeding distance equal to the 5 times he hit his, until it was out so far that nobody could see it any longer and he couldn't tell whether or not I was hitting it. I rested my case for the M16 on semi versus the M60 on full. Tried to collect my case of Cokes, which of course was impossible. Meandered back to the bird, along with the chaplain, who was telling me how good he was with his Browning high power after shooting it 26 times and not being able to hit a thing. Well, I take that back. He did throw a few bullets down at the backstop. But we patted ourselves on the back and headed back towards the aircraft again to wait. Now, we've had no breakfast so far, and it is getting to be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, so that means we've also had no lunch so far either. Unfortunately, the crew chief and the door gunner seem to neglect to bring any seas over, or keep any seas on the birds, so we're all hungry and very much out of sorts. The weather's cleared off. It's one of those beautiful days that begins after noon, when the clouds all blow away. Cool, sunny, crisp, and windy. We climb into the bird, crank up the engine, And the colonel gets in, and we all prepare to head back to Song Bay. The trip back was relatively uneventful, being the type of flying conditions for which the UH-1H helicopter was designed for, IFR at about 3,000 feet above the ground, safely out of the range of gooks, trees, Chinooks, and dusty roads. The only thing that could happen to us is engine failures, rotor failures, transmission failures, and structural failures. Fortunately, none of this happened all the way back to Song Bay, and we landed without incident. I immediately head back to my AO, rejoicing at the thought that I have almost the rest of the afternoon off. It's about 3 o'clock by this time. We go to the mess hall, and there's nothing left but a 4-foot by 2-foot pan of cake and warm milk. On the verge of starving to death, I ate 6 pieces of cake and 2 pints of milk. After that, I was feeling really sick and went back to my AO to sack out. Now, unfortunately, we have a unique generator. It only seems to run when nobody messes with it, which is between the hours of midnight and 6 a.m. The rest of the time, there's somebody always over there doing something with it, trying to make it run a little bit better or put out a little bit more juice or make lights brighter or something. And so consequently, it refuses to run when people mess with it. Well, this happened to be one of those times. Somebody had been messing with it, and we had no power from about 9 o'clock that morning and till that time. Well, this doesn't bother me too much because all I wanted to do was sack out and recapture the hours of lost sleep. Wait one. The only disadvantage being having no power when you intend to sleep the rest of the afternoon is you have nothing to run your fan. Vietnam's a very unusual place. It's really quite tolerable if you have a fan. If you have a good fan. If you have a fan that runs smoothly, quietly, and blows a lot of air without that terrible high-velocity sting. Fortunately, I have such a fan. It took me a great number of months to exactly develop it. I had to trim the blades exactly just right, took the guard off of it so it wouldn't hiss and rattle. The rotating mechanism has been slowed down so that it's a very sedate speed. The fan is perfect. It blows mosquitoes, gnats, bugs, flies, and just about anything else away from you without stirring up a great deal of dust. And keeps you cool. But when there's no electricity, it's hotter than hell. Along with the gnats, flies, bugs, mosquitoes, and other things that come in and bother you when you're trying to sleep in the middle of the afternoon, wondering, why in the hell is he trying to sleep? Everybody else is awake. Well, my nap only lasted about an hour. I was awakened and informed that we had another mission. Again, I donned my chicken plate, my M16, and my helmet, and head for the helicopter. We go out to the helicopter, we crank up, and we move it back onto the VIP pad. And we reduce it to flight idle, sit back, pick up our Playboys, begin reading and waiting again for the colonel. Now, the colonel's a very prompt man. He wants everybody else to be prompt, and if we're late, he wants to know why. But for some reason, he tells us to be there at 4:30, and we're there at 4:30. But he doesn't come out until 5, and when he does, he sends his aide, who comes running out, saying, the colonel has decided not to go to Benoit, so you can shut down and park it. We log 30 minutes worth of flight time, go over to the refueling area, pull up, and park it in the revetments, shutting down, locking up, and going back to our AOs. I come into operations. Now, this has been a most exasperating day. I've spent most of the time sitting in the aircraft, getting very little flight time, but I'm just dead tired. So I have good news when I get to operations. Mr. Jackson is still out flying. I think to myself, he's still out sitting someplace, waiting for somebody to get ready to go somewhere. And he has Officer of the Guard on the orange sector of the Green Line. Now, the orange sector of the Green Line is a very interesting thing. The entire line is called the Green Line. It's divided off into five zones. Orange, black. Orange, black, red, and white. Sectors, which are little areas approximately a quarter to a half a mile long that it comes under the command of one specific OD. Well, this is a little detail that's passed around and around to each of the officers and warrant officers in the company. It's not passed around equally, but it's definitely passed around. And it seems like it has been passed to me. So I obligingly march up to the talk to get my briefing from Captain Kelly. Captain Kelly is a very nice man. I eat dinner with him every single night and exchange war stories and philosophies of life and everything else. For some strange reason, he turns into a raving tyrant when I get up for briefing on my few occasions to serve as off as Oscar Dildo, as we call it. That's OD. And he gives me my briefing and lets me know that they expect sampler tags. Well, that's groovy. We will have sampler tags tonight. Okay. And we will use starlight scopes. All right, that's groovy. We'll use the starlight scopes. And is there anything else, Mr. Crane? And I say, yes, I need a Jeep. Now, the Jeep is a very interesting vehicle. It's not too good for much altitude, but when you want a low level, it's just dandy for any speed below 40 knots. Makes it very suitable for inspecting your half-mile section of Green Line regularly, driving up, checking each bunker, which are placed strategically at every 20 yards or so, asking, delivering coffee and cookies and what have you, and resupplying ammunition that people forgot, or cots, or mosquito nets, or steel pots, or flares, or anything else that arises. Radios and so forth. Well, it's a real interesting outfit. The aviation platoon is part of Head and Head Company. Head and Head Company contains no less than five staff officers' positions. The S1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, plus the XO, plus the CEO, plus the CEO of Head and Head Company. This is seven people. Five. CEO, XO, and CO. Eight people. Okay, this is eight people. Every single one of these men have a Jeep. Every single one of these men is above the rank of captain. Every single one of these men has a driver. And every single one of these men gets together every single night and gets drunk and has no use for any one of their eight Jeeps. Each authority, under each S position, staff position, there's probably maybe five or six officers. With one exception. In the aviation platoon itself, there's probably about 10 officers. Now, we're very fortunate in that we have that many more people to split up our details with. We're unfortunate in that the only vehicles of transportation we have all have rotor blades on them and stir up a great deal of dust, making them completely unsuitable for checking green lines, sneaking up on guards, smoking pot, punching whores, or sniffing heroin. Although I'm not so sure it hasn't been tried. We do fortunately have a mule. A mule's a very interesting little vehicle. It has four wheels that are 12 inches in diameter. It's a platform a little bit bigger than my little red wagon when I was 8 years old. And has a three-speed gearbox and a four-cylinder Volkswagen engine on the back. It'll do all of about 12 miles an hour, and it's just dandy for carrying all kinds of things, which is its primary designation. It has no suspension whatsoever. It has four-wheel steering and four-wheel drive. It has no lights, no horn, and no top or windshield. Well, each unit or each staff position that is supplying the Oscar Dildo for that particular night is supposed to supply that Oscar Dildo with a Jeep. Ordinarily, we get our Jeep from wherever we can get our Jeep from. Generally, getting a Jeep takes no less than 3 hours and sometimes as many as 5 hours. I've worked until midnight trying to get a Jeep occasionally, talking people out of theirs. Of course, they're usually asleep or drunk or don't care. But they all have a reason why they can't give me their Jeep. Either I haven't got a military driver's license, or it's only got a few more hours till it needs the oil changed. Or, it only has four tires and the spare's flat. Or, somebody might need it for something. It always amazes me that somebody might need it for something. It takes priority over somebody definitely needs it for something. Well, anyway, having been through this routine before, I decided the easiest way to get a Jeep is to go out and find one that says 2nd Brigade HHC. That's me, right? Head and head company. If I take a Jeep that's in my company, they can hardly charge me with stealing a Jeep, so I do. And it turns out it's the S5s. It's, very little to do with it. It could have been the S1s or the XOs. It really makes no difference to me whatsoever. I jump in the Jeep, start it up. I take no less than 10 minutes to start the Jeep. For some reason, I'm not too adept at starting Jeeps. Starting Hueys, I can do. Starting Jeeps, I'm a little rusty at. Driving Jeeps, I'm a little rusty at. Having a little trouble with their 5-speed transmission with select four-wheel drive. It does take me all of 5 minutes to get the thing running. Now, 5 minutes may not seem like a very long time, but when you're stealing a Jeep, it's a long, long time. But nobody said a word. I drove off in the Jeep and around the corner and over to my guard section and gave my guard briefing. I get to the briefing. Well, half the guards aren't there, so I give the briefing to the half the guards that are there. Mark the rest of them down as AWOL. They'll come in, they'll give me an excuse, and I take their name off the AWOL list. If the guard decides that he's going to go straight to his position without coming in and giving me an excuse, I turn him in for being AWOL. It makes no difference whatsoever to me what the excuse is, because if he comes to me with an excuse, I just accept it just like that. May not be the military way, but it saves a lot of arguing. So, after my guards are briefed, I have 75% of them in their positions. They're all supplied with ammunition, and I have communication with almost all of them. I drive up and down the road very quietly, sniffing. I smell some marijuana, stop the Jeep, walk over to the bunker, say, "All right, you guys." Immediately, out of the bunker fly 5 cigarettes. Now, this is most unique. Guys don't usually douse their cigarettes simultaneously together with such panic-stricken looks on their face. I, of course, know that they're not really cigarettes. They're marijuana joints. Marijuana joints is something everybody smokes in Vietnam, but nobody talks about. I smoke it. They smoke it. They know I smoke it. I know they smoke it. And we all act like nobody smokes it. It's really a unique position. Smoking marijuana while on guard is hazardous only if you should happen to get caught. It's hazardous to the men if I catch them. It's hazardous to me if somebody catches my men. They'll never catch me, because I don't smoke when I'm OD. That is until after midnight, and I'm sure that the ground attack for tonight has been canceled. Well, to continue with the story of one day, it seems that they finally have decided that I have stolen the Jeep from the S5. The S5 sent a man over in another Jeep to go pick it up. Well, the man in the other Jeep has something else to do, so asked me if I would return it, please. I oblige him and say, "Well, I've finished briefing my guards, checked my line out. I probably won't need it for the rest of the night. I can do the rest on foot." So I take the Jeep back over to the S5 spot where I found it, parked in the street, and climb out and walk away. As I round a corner, a very panic-stricken looking E6 walks up and says, "Sir, did you just bring that Jeep back?" And I said, "Yep." He says, "The S1 was looking for that. And I say, "Is that all?" And walk off. He comes running up again. "Wait a minute. I better have your name." "My name is Mr. Crane. I'm in the aviation platoon." "Well, I'm going to have to turn you into the OD tonight for this little incident. This is a very unique situation. It seems he's going to turn me into me." The OD is in charge of everything that happens. It takes the place of the colonel at night. So I say, "I think that's a very good idea," and suggest that he could get the OD in the shack in the orange sector probably later on this evening, and he assures me that he will, politely takes my name, politely salutes, politely runs off in a panic-stricken manner. He thinks he's fooling me, but I know the truth of the matter is he's in more hot water for leaving the Jeep unlocked and unsecured than I am for taking the Jeep in the first place. I had a good reason for taking it. He didn't have a good reason for leaving it unlocked. I go back to my orange sector, check out my guards, and ride the mule back to the mess hall. The evening mess is really something to see. It consists of standing, sitting, or walking around the mess hall with a beer in your hand and a cigarette in the other hand, looking like you're enjoying yourself when really nothing could be farther from the truth. You're missing the movie that the EM are watching, and you're hungry anyway. At 7:30, the colonel will either stand up or come in. He will stand up if he's already in, and if he's out, he will come in. In either case, everybody will come to attention by his place. The colonel will walk to his seat at the center of the long table and nod to the chaplain, who will then say a blessing. This is the same chaplain I had also gone out shooting with earlier this afternoon, and is really a jovial character. His blessings consists of, "Yea, God, let's eat," or, "Yea, God, let's eat, I'm beat," or, "Praise the Lord, pass the ammunition and the grub," or, every now and then he comes out with, "God is great, God is good, and we thank him for the dead gooks today." But anyway, there's a very brief prayer. We all sit down and begin sipping our beer or drinks or what have you until the colonel's table is served. Then in a very orderly fashion, starting at the end closest to the kitchen door, we file in groups of four and five through the line and serve ourselves, come back, sit down, and begin eating. About the middle way through the meal, especially if you sit at the end table, the colonel jumps up and everybody jumps up at the head table. Nobody really seems to know why everybody else jumps up at the head table. I don't think it's proper etiquette, but anyway, everybody jumps up. Nobody else and then the rest of the tables jumps up. Just the people who sit at the head table jump up. If the people who sit at the head table happen to be late that day and don't get a place at the head table, and they have to be sitting at the tables around at the foot of the head table, they also jump up. So it's the same head table people that are always jumping up. This interrupts the meal to no degree because you're in the midst of either chewing or cutting your steak or something, and you have to stop and look blankly around like, what a bunch of idiots, while the colonel walks out. The colonel leaves, everybody returns to eating and talking, and it really gets lively by this time because you've waited so long on an empty stomach without having anything to eat. You've consumed six beers and you're completely smashed. That is, unless you're Oscar Dildo for tonight, and that night I happen to be Oscar Dildo. So, of course, I refrain from smashing myself, which always sounds like a good thing to do. People shouldn't smash themselves. And return to my sector on the orange sector. My section on the orange sector. My place on the orange sector. About this time, my sergeant of the guard comes up and says that the E6 that lost the Jeep had come in and filed a report on me, claiming that I had stolen the Jeep, and so on and so forth, so on and so forth. I immediately look over the report, say thank you very much to my sergeant of the guard, go out and check bunker 16. Sergeant of the guard salutes, goes out and checks bunker 16. I tear up the report and throw it in the trash can and say, Thinking of the army bureaucracy. That's the end of the stolen Jeep episode. It's tradition for the OD to stay up all night long to see that nothing happens, or to catch it if it does happen, or to make a report on it. It's very unique. You're supposed to stay up all night and then make a report. I generally make up the report and then stay up all night, because if I stay up all night and then make a report, the report sounds like I made it after I've stayed up all night. So I make out my report for the next morning, citing everything as completely uneventful except bunkers 3, 4, and 5. Two men were asleep. I leave the actual bunker numbers and the names of the men in blank and fill them in the morning when I catch them. I am so sure of catching them that I always leave at least three and then go out and hunt for them. I continue to hunt until I found three, and then I can take it easy. I don't report any serious violations of narcotics. This is an extremely messy affair, and which involves going to Ben court-martial trials as witnesses and so on and so forth, and something I just totally detest. So therefore, I never catch anybody smoking or shooting anything. Asleep, yes. When a guard is caught asleep, he's brought in before the commander, read his rights under Article 31, asked if he will accept an Article 15. He says yes. They fine him $15 and put him on extra duty. Cancel his pass for the weekend so that he'll try to do better next time. Well, and that's about the way it is on guard. The next morning at 7:30, we drive around in our Jeeps or trucks, pick up all the ammunition, the M16s and Starlight scopes, put them in a Connex container, lock up the Connex container, sign a report, submit the report to the commanding officer. He relieves us of our duty as Oscar Dildo, and I return immediately back to bed. It's been a very long day, having been up for 24 hours or better with only a brief nap, and that was without my fan. Unfortunately, again, the electricity had been on all night, but it's off now. So, what can I say? So this pretty well concludes a rather normal, but then again, it's not really normal. Just say a composite day in the life of one officer aviator. It's funny looking back on it, but while you're living through it, it's just on the verge of being completely miserable. If I neglected writing my wife, you will please excuse that during that day. You'll notice I also neglected picking up my mail. Picking up your mail is something you must do when you have lots and lots of patients, because it requires no less than 1 hour to do. You stand in the mail line, hoping you have a letter. You get up there, the mail clerk says nope, without even looking in his stack of mail. You don't have a letter. Then you decide, maybe I do and maybe I don't. It really has nothing to do with what the clerk said, because the clerk always says you have no mail. You then can walk around, come back in a few minutes and insist that you have some mail, or you can insist immediately that you have some mail. I generally insist immediately that I have mail, with the expectation that my wife sends me one letter for every day of the week. That means 7 letters a week. I generally get these on Tuesdays and Thursdays. For some reason, my wife also sends me my letter every day on one day for 3 days. For some reason, that's exactly the way it arrives. The same postmark and everything. But it does boast some morale, so I browbeat the clerk until he either lets me come in and search for my own mail or happens to stumble across it on his own, which is also a very amazing feat if he should stumble across it on his own. And you can also see I've completely obliterated this tape that you recorded for me and sent to me. Well, I was getting tired of listening to Bridge Over Troubled Water, bubbly music, and Johnny Rivers. So I'm going to record this on it and send it back to you so you can record me some more music or some more voice and send it back to me. How does that sound? Okay. I really thought my story would last longer than 45 minutes, but it doesn't seem to have lasted longer than 45 minutes. Now I wish I'd recorded it on an hour tape. Oh, well. You win some and you lose some. I can't tell you how deserted it's beginning to get around here. Just about everybody's left. First of the Ninth is gone. Charlie is over here no longer, which is really sad. Unfortunately, he left before I could get Sharon's telephone number that you requested, but if I see him again, I'll get it. I trust that the address you have is good. I haven't heard any word on it, but I know I've sent you her address. Maybe she's just not writing. I don't know. And if I see Tucker, I'll try to get you his wife's address. Charlie pulled out last night, and we're going?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have been on a weather hold here for the last 45 minutes, and it seems that the weather has cleared and we can now take off and fly away. So, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Take off and fly away. And I will return shortly. Maybe I'll return longly. Longingly? Quickly? Soonly? Sometime within the next 4 months, I should return. So, I say goodbye for now. Don my trusty 45, pick up my trusty M16, and march out to my not-so-trusty helicopter. Goodbye. Well, it is the next day, March the 8th. Yesterday, we stood down. It was a very interesting afternoon. I went out and flew 4 hours worth of missions. I came back and they said, pack up, we're moving out. And much to my disgust, grumble, 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 I packed up once again. Although ever since Alpha Company, I've been traveling light with only a footlocker and a duffel bag and my helmet bag, and that's about it, you know. My 45 and 16 and ammunition and chicken plate and all that stays loose. But anyway, so we packed up and commenced to